joining us right now, actor and now author, Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. 7900991 Star Talk 1-800-491-CJD. Those are the numbers to call. Lines free if you want to call in. And those of you who sure remember Ephraim from such television shows as the FBI and 77 Sunset Strip. Hello, sir. How are you?
Oh, I'm very well, thank you.
Thanks for being on the program with us.
Well, it's a joy. I'm so happy that we could get together.
You probably did a lot to help save flagging ABC in the early days of that network.
Well, I was one of them. You know, we were. Warner Brothers was the whole ABC primetime product. We had 10 shows, primetime shows, and they were all ABC. And ABC was then the starving network. You know, they were very poor, and in those years they came right up and became number one. So we all had played a part in it. It was a very happy part.
Now you have written a book, as I mentioned. The book is called My Dinner of Herbs, and interesting title. What does it mean?
Well, it's from a phrase in the Book of Proverbs. Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a stalled ox and hatred therewith. So it's a book telling, I think, about a lot of the love that surrounded my life from my family and friends and so forth, and which is continuing, you know, in these latter years with that same kind of... And also, it's a book I wrote with the hope that it would bring pleasure to people and not anxiety and unpleasantness and stress or gossip or whatever, but just a book that would help people enjoy an evening or a day or two of reading it.
You had quite a long run, as I mentioned, on ABC. Your first series, which was 77 Sunset Strip, went for what, 7 years?
6 years.
Six years.
It went for 5 years, and then Jack Warner got in a fit of temper and fired the whole studio, practically. Fired the whole television department, fired all the actors under contract, let the contracts lapse, and I was the only actor left on the contract. There had been 50-odd. And he changed, at that point, the format of 77, which had been on 4 years, and it just changed it completely and brought in Jack Webb as a producer of television and Bill Conrad as our producer. And we started out on a whole new tack, and, I mean, totally different show from the old one. Not a bad show, but that's not at all the show that had been on before and that people had come to enjoy. So it came as a terrible shock, I think, to the audience. It was a miscalculation in the first order.
Yeah, because for those who remember the show originally, the title of the show, 77 Sunset Strip, basically dealt with what, the detective agency that...
Yeah.
That you guys worked at, and there was Ed Kookie Barnes in the parking lot, at least.
That's right.
For the first year, and then he became one of your partners.
That's right.
And I think that's what people remember most about the show, and then the last year that it was on, as you said, it was just you.
Yeah.
Or you and new cast members, and your role kind of changed. You were traveling the world, and there's a little bit of espionage involved, and...
What I became was a carbon copy of Jack Webb in Gunsmoke.
Dragnet.
Dragnet.
Right.
Even to the same clothes. I talked like him, and it was a copy of Jack Webb, and it was a bad copy.
Mm-hmm.
And my part in that year that we were on was terrible. I think I was awful. But there were some very good shows, nonetheless.
Now, when all the changes were made, and you were the only one to survive all those changes, did you kind of look around and go, why am I here, and can I get out, or do I just ride this one through?
Well, there was nothing I could do. You know, I was under contract, and when you were under contract to the studios in those days, you either... You know, if you wanted to get out, you went to court, and you sued them and hoped you'd win and so forth. But other than that, which I never had any desire to do, you just had to do what they told you to do. And so I just did this show. I figured, well, they must know something. So I went ahead, but it only lasted 1 year.
Mm. We are talking with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. here on Montreal's News Talk Leader CJD 800. A renowned actor. He's now also an author. His book is called My Dinner of Herbs. If you have any questions, line 3-7900-991, star talk, 1-800-491-CJD.
Now more of CJAD's Holder Overnight on Montreal's News Talk Leader, CJAD 800. To speak with Peter, call 790-0991, star talk, a free call on Bell Mobility, and 800-491-CJAD.
Anthony Holder here with you on Montreal's News Talk Leader, CJAD 800. We are talking with actor Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. He has a new book out called My Dinner of Herbs. And I'm sure, Ephraim, that music sounds very familiar to you.
You know, I hadn't heard that in such a long time.
Theme song for the television show The FBI. And I remember when I was a kid watching that show, I always used to look forward to the beginning of the brand new season. Because I'm a big fan of television. I always want to know what kind of little changes television shows did when a new season started. But with the FBI, the thing I wanted to know is, would you be coming out of that big building and would you be getting into a brand new Ford?
Oh, you know, that we used to go back to Washington every May, and I went back with a skeleton crew, and we'd shoot just drive-ins and drive-outs all around Washington in the new Ford, which wouldn't be out until October.
Right.
So they put together a thing which they shipped down to Washington, and just for this purpose. And they kept it under wraps in a huge truck and until the moment when I had to get into it and drive. And it was, when I got in, it was a total wreck. I mean, there was nothing inside. There was no dashboard. There was no upholstery. There was nothing. It was just a shell. But on the outside, it looked like the model that would be out in October. And if you slammed the door, it would fall off. I mean, it was just stuck together with spirit gum and scotch tape. So I'd drive it around to Washington and so forth. And then after two or three days, they'd put it back in the truck and ship it to Dearborn, where it would be cubed and destroyed. And that would be the end of its life.
So the only person who got to drive this car basically was you.
And that was the only thing that was new every year was the car and the clothes.
Right. Now, what was also unique about the show, I guess, it had a very strong connection with Ford,
yep,
the automaker.
And, well, all of the Warner shows had.
And it had a very strong connection with the FBI itself.
Yes, indeed. Yes, it did.
Is it true that J. Edgar Hoover actually had to approve your casting in the role?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about it. Well, you see, for Hoover, it represented a sort of a training film for the FBI. He felt that the FBI was on display, and so he wanted to, he liked, what happened was he had turned down, I think, 600 applications for series, and then he allowed Warner Brothers to make a movie that Mervyn LeRoy directed with Jimmy Stewart called The FBI Story. And he liked it so much that they won him over, and he agreed to let them do a series. And that was the sort of genesis of the whole thing. I had finished 77 about a year and a half before this, and I really was tired of being in a series, and I was glad to be out. But in that year and a half, I wasn't very happy with the properties that came my way. I did a couple of good movies and some good television specials. But on the whole, I felt that it was not a very promising period. And so I called my agent and I said, you know, if you could get me a good series, I'd like to go back into it. And he said, well, Warner Brothers has got this series called The FBI, and they've called Quinn Martin to produce it, and let me call him. Well, an hour later, we had a deal, and that was how it all happened.
Did you actually meet with J. Edgar Hoover?
Oh, I not only met with him, I met with him every year when we went back to Washington to do these drive-ins. I had a meeting with him, And we became good friends in the sense that I didn't see him on a regular basis, but I knew him quite well, and he wrote to me many, many letters. I have, you know, maybe 50 or 100 letters that he wrote me, brief but friendly, and he liked the show. He liked the way it was, he liked what he was doing for the FBI. So we had a very, very good relationship.
Would you say that in the years that show was on, which was basically from 1965 to 1964, that you probably had a good hand in FBI recruiting?
Well, it was one of those situations where we probably helped the FBI quite a bit, but at the same time, the FBI helped us. So it was one hand feeding the other. I mean, we both benefited from the relationship.
We're talking with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. here on Montreal's News Talk Leader, CJD 800-790-0991, Star Talk 1-800-491-CJD. Those are the numbers to call. Gord in Saint Laurent, hi, you're on CJD.
Hello, Peter.
Hi.
Hello, Ephraim.
Yes.
I used to really love your show when I was a kid.
In our locality,
it used to be on every Friday night at 10. And
that's right.
A few nights a week, I used to be able to stay up. Anyway, I got two questions for you. One, the cases that were profiled on the FBI, on your show, were they based on real cases?
Well, let me put it this way. The FBI opened their files to the show.
Okay.
And they said we could use any case that we wanted. And they had so many cases that literally every kind of case was there. I mean, you didn't have to manufacture any. But writers being what they are, many writers felt that it was beneath their dignity to take some ready-made plot and dress it up. So they would insist on writing their own shows. And very often what happened was that they would write a show. Let's say they'd write a show about a jewelry theft. And it happened that the FBI had no jurisdiction over jewelry theft. And so the studio would have to throw the script out and they'd end up, you know, writing something that they did have jurisdiction over. But in essence, that's what happened. They didn't care that much if the writer wrote a script on his own that was something that the FBI was authorized to deal in. But the trouble was that the writers didn't know, really. So we often had problems that way.
My last question. Bill Conrad, is this the Bill William Conrad of Cannon fame?
Yes.
You bet.
Oh,
you
okay.
bet. One of the most gifted men in Hollywood, he was.
A lot more to just act.
Oh, he was our producer the last year of 77. And he directed a number of our shows. Excellent director. In fact, he was at that point the only director at Warner Brothers. They'd fired everybody else. And he had great plans for movies that he hoped to make and so forth. But they didn't materialize because Warner Brothers collapsed. Jack Warner was on his way out very soon after that. But he was a very, very gifted and a nice man.
Okay, Gord.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Bye-bye. 790-0991, Star Talk, 1-800-491-CJD. Jim, downtown. Hi, you're on CJD.
Good evening.
Hi.
How are you?
Fine, and you?
Okay.
Good. You have a question for Ephraim Zimbalist Jr.?
Yeah. So, Ephraim, where's Jimmy Hoffa?
Where did I what?
Where's Jimmy Hoffa?
I don't think he would know that, Jim. You have a serious question?
Yeah. There were cameos done, exchange cameos with 77 Sunset Strip and Surfside 6.
Well, you know,
wasn't that developed? Because you also, I believe, did a cameo with another series that was based in New Orleans with Richard Crenna or Richard Long or Richard Egan. I don't recall.
Richard Long, I think it was. There was some crossbreeding between shows, like Jim
that
Garner
was very interesting.
Was on 77 once and so on. But at the same time, I used to read every script. We had 10 series going at Warner's, and I used to read all the scripts of all the shows. And I would go to them, and if I'd find a part that I liked, I'd ask to play if I could play it. And they usually let me do it. And so there was one week when I did four shows at the same time, including my own. So I did a maverick, which developed into a character that I repeated several times, Dandy Jim Buckley, and I did I think Hawaiian Eye, but I did...
Hawaiian Eye?
Oh, Hawaiian Eye, yes. Yeah,
well, I think I did Hawaiian Eye.
Who was in that? Please.
Robert Conrad.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I did, what's that thing that Roger Moore had a series? I worked
the
on
Saint.
That.
Huh? The Saint.
No, long before that. When he was under contract at Warner, he had his...
Ivanhoe?
No, The Alaskans, I think it was called.
Okay.
And I worked on that, and another one that... I worked on about five or six of the series, just because I liked the part.
Mm-hmm. What was the series that was based in New Orleans called?
Oh, dear, what was that called? Just my memory of names is so rotten.
No. Bourbon Street?
Bourbon Street, that's right. Bourbon Street.
And Al Hurt, was that Peter Gunn?
Peter Gunn was the Al Hurt one.
Uh-huh.
Peter Gunn was, no, that wasn't
with Craig,
one.
With Craig Stevens?
Craig
yes.
Stevens, yeah.
Yeah.
That was a top-rated show.
Yeah.
How old are you now?
86. 84. I'm sorry, I'm lying.
Are you going to be Kirk Douglas?
The wrong way.
Okay.
I'm 84.
I thank you for the call, Jim. 790-0991 Star Talk, 1-800-491-CJD for the Laurentians, Eastern Townships, Ottawa, Hull area, and also the border states. Those are the numbers to call. We are speaking with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., who has a new book out called My Dinner of Herbs. As I mentioned, I was a big, big fan of the FBI. I was a little on the young side when 77 Sunset Strip came out, although I did see some of it in reruns later on. But seeing you on the FBI, the one thing about Inspector Louis Erskine, the best thing I can say, he was not a partier.
He looked like a partier?
He was not a partier.
Oh, no.
He was a very serious guy.
Well, you know, one of the challenges that I really enjoyed about that show, if I had been a producer, for example, and someone had come to me and said, I have a great idea for a series, the only thing is the leading characters can't smoke. They can't put their hands in their pockets. They can't have anything to do with women. They can't drink. They have to be polite. I'd say, great idea. Take it to somebody down the hall, will you? I mean, it had all the ingredients to make it a stiff bore. And the challenge for me was to have it not be that. And it was I loved that challenge. I loved having to work within those very narrow confines and still try to make something interesting of the character, something universal that wouldn't bore people.
We are talking with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. here on Montreal's News Talk Leader, CJAD 800. The book is called My Dinner of Herbs. 7900-991 is the number to call. Star Talk, 1-800-491-CJAD. We have another half hour to go with Ephraim. We'll continue on the other side of the news. This is Montreal's News Talk Leader, CJAD 800.
Now more of CJAD's Halder Overnight on Montreal's News Talk Leader, CJAD 800. To speak with Peter, call 790-0991. Star Talk, a free call on Bell Mobility, and 800-491-CJAD.
Peter Anthony Holder here with you on Montreal's News Talk Leader, CJAD 800. We are talking with actor Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., who has a new book out called My Dinner of Herbs. And, of course, he played the role of former OSS officer Stu Bailey on the television series 77 Sunset Strip. How did you get that role?
Well, I was under contract at Warner's,
mm-hmm.
and I had done... six movies for them, and they suddenly announced that they wanted me to make a TV pilot. And I said, no, not me. I don't want to. I'd come to Hollywood and not even knowing that they had TV at Warner Brothers. Well, they showed me a clause in my contract that said I had to do it if they wanted me to. So I made the pilot, and it didn't sell. It was turned down by ABC. I was delighted. But they tell you, well, we're going to make another one. So they made the other one, and that one did sell. And so that's how 77 began. And I have no complaints. But I didn't particularly want to do it. I had just finished a movie that I absolutely loved with a director I loved and a cast. And I the thought of going into a TV series at that point was just something I just didn't want to do. But as life turns out, you know, TV was very good to me, and I you know, the fact that most of my life was spent on the small screen is fine with me. I have no complaints.
How do you feel generally about the old studio system?
Oh, I loved it. I thought it was the greatest thing for actors that there could be. We weren't paid very much, but we were used. The studio, you know, used you in all kinds of things. A lot of things you hated and a lot of things that you loved. But they kept you busy. You worked and worked and worked, and that's really what was wonderful. And there was like a protection of your life, and they publicized you, and they were back of you with their publicity campaigns and so forth, and they built up stars, and I think it was a marvelous system. But it was for its day. I mean, today it's entirely different. Probably wouldn't work today at all.
We are talking with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. He is the author of a new book called My Dinner of Herbs, which is just coming out, right?
Yes, it is, just now.
Yeah. 7900-991 Star Talk, 1-800-491-CJD. For the Laurentians, Eastern Townships, Ottawa Hull area, and also the border states, those are the numbers to call. And speaking of the border states, we go to Bill in Vermont. Hello, Bill. Hi, you're on CJD.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Hi, Ephraim.
Hello, Bill. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm just wondering what your daughter Stephanie has been up to. I haven't heard much about her, and I remember how lovely she was.
Well, thank you, Bill. As a matter of fact, she's at the moment not too far from you. She's in Cambridge, Massachusetts, about to open a play there on the, I think it's the 2nd of August.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, it's a play about Chopin and his lady friend, George Sand. And she plays that part.
I saw her on television at least twice this past television season doing Crossing Jordan episode,
yes,
and
yes,
also a Judging Amy episode I saw her on.
That's right. That's right. But she keeps busy all the time. She does a lot of theater. She loves the theater.
Well, that's great. I just hadn't seen, happened to catch her on television doing anything, and I was glad I could ask you that. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thanks for asking. Bye-bye. 7900-991 Star Talk, 1-800-491-CJD. Those are the numbers to call. Line's free if you want to call in. We are talking to Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. here on CJD. Speaking of your daughter, Stephanie, and also going back to what I said earlier about how your role in the FBI, Louis Erskine, was not a guy for a lot of laughs, per se. When I got the chance to see you doing a role on Remington Steele, it was quite a different Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. than I had grown up watching.
I loved doing it. I appeared four times on her series, and I loved it. I loved the role. I loved working with her. It was just a wonderful time we had. Oddly enough, she didn't like me in the picture at all.
No, why not?
Well, I was. She thought I was up to no good.
Now, which character, the Louis Erskine character or the shadier character you played on Remington Steele? Which one is closer to Ephraim Zimbalist Jr.?
I don't know. I mean, I have no idea. I think, you know, I feel that an actor, and probably anybody else in life for that matter, I only know it because I am an actor, but I feel that I, in my life, I've been the sum total of all the people that I've admired, growing up and into my, you know, mature years. Not that I tried to copy them, but they just had an effect on me, and so enough of them combined to make me what I am today. And I think probably that's true of all of us, whether we think about it or not. But who I am, and I really don't know. I don't know much about that.
I know that your new book, My Dinner of Herbs, talks about many things, including growing up in into a legendary musical family.
Yes. Well, you know, it's a book of stories. Some people have a peculiar affinity for having funny things happen to them or bizarre things happen to them throughout life. My father was one of those people. I mean, he was he had ridiculous, absurd, preposterous things happening to him all his life, and he told about them. He was a marvelous storyteller, and he had a great sense of humor. And for some reason, I inherited some of that because I had my share of things, and that these stories my children grew up hearing and so forth. And it was Stephanie who said to me some years ago, she said, you know, you should really write about these things. And I thought, well, yeah, someday. And I'll be the only, I prided myself on being the only actor in Hollywood who never wrote a book. But I really had no desire to, because to me, the idea of saying, you know, writing a book about first I did this and then I did that had no interest for me at all. I don't care about it, and I don't think the audience cares about it. But the stories were something else. And she really got on me and wouldn't let go. And that's really how this book came out, because she sat down and interviewed me and took all these stories down, and then she transcribed them in horrible English into a book. And I was enjoying life too much. I didn't want to spend the time writing a book. So she finally said she talked about getting somebody to write it. And at that point, I woke up and I said, wait a minute. Now, wait a minute. If anybody's going to write these stories, I'd sure like to do it myself.
So would you say the book is roughly, basically anecdotal to things that happened?
It's largely anecdotal. It's just somewhat historical, but I would say it's more about other people than about me. And it's only about me in so far as it shows things that make a good story. If there are a whole bunch of things in my life that don't appear in the book at all, because there wasn't a story there. But I only wrote what I thought would be interesting to a reading audience to learn about, or to laugh about, or to maybe sob a little bit about, but to enjoy in a quiet and sort of amusing way. That's about all it is. It's not an attempt to foist my life on other people or to tell them about my theatrical achievements and so forth. That's to me boring beyond belief.
I haven't had the opportunity to read the book yet, since it's just coming out, but it sounds, the way you describe it, somewhat like a book that I read several years ago, which got quite a lot of coverage and renown, and that is David Niven's The Moon is a Balloon.
Well, I'm a huge fan of David Niven as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think people, he was underestimated enormously. He wasn't an actor who wrote. He was a writer. I mean, those Bring On Your Empty Horses and Moon's a Balloon were superb books, I think.
Absolutely.
And if my book were on the same shelf as his, I'd feel just honored beyond belief.
We are talking with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. here on Montreal's News Talk Leader CJD. About 15 minutes to go with Ephraim. 7900991 Star Talk, 1-800-491-CJD. If you have any questions for Mr. Zimbalist, he has a new book out called My Dinner of Herbs. Just a word for Antico Martini Restaurant, speaking of herbs. You've heard me talk about the VO. Let's talk about the rack of lamb. How many different ways can you say yummy? Antico Martini has tender morsels of lamb on feather bones with fresh vegetables of the day. You have to try it. Why? Because Antico Martini is a fine Italian restaurant that has been serving Montrealers for over 25 years. So if they have a specialty, you know it's done right. Antico Martini Restaurant, for those who really care, 6450 Summerled near Cavendish. For reservations, call 489-6804.
Now more of CJAD's Holder Overnight on Montreal's News Talk Leader, CJAD 800. To speak with Peter, call 790-0991, Star Talk, a free call on Bell Mobility, and 800-491-CJAD.
Peter Anthony Holder here with you on Montreal's News Talk Leader, CJAD 800. We are talking with actor Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. His new book is called My Dinner of Herbs. 7900991 is the number to call. As we mentioned, you grew up in a legendary musical family. Was there ever a thought of you going into the family business, as opposed to acting?
Well, my parents both believed that that music is a part of education. They wanted both my sister and me to learn an instrument. I studied the violin. My sister, the piano. My father had Heifetz's father teach me. I studied the violin for about 8 years, something like that, and developed a modest proficiency in it. But I never wanted to be a violinist, and they never wanted me to be a violinist. It was, as I say, just the enrichment of life to know an instrument. That was the way they looked at it.
Were your parents appreciative of your work as an actor? Did they get a chance to see you succeed as an actor?
Well, my mother didn't. I chose to be an actor for all the wrong reasons when I was young. I mean, I thought it was easy to begin with. I thought it was glamorous, a lot of beautiful women, and a lot of money, and all the wrong reasons on earth. And my mother knew it, and she was disgusted, you know, with this little flirtation I had with being an actor. My father wasn't too happy about it, but he backed me all through my life. Anything I wanted to do, he was behind me 100%, and he was in this. He helped me, because there wasn't much he could do, but he was behind me all through my life, and he became a little bit proud, you know, at the end, and he moved out west, and I think he kind of liked to see what I was in, because I'd made such a terrible mess of my life growing up, but at least it was a little turnaround.
So you got into acting for all the wrong reasons, but you soon realized that it is a job. There is a lot of work. There's a lot of negative sides to it. There's a lot of pitfalls to it.
Right.
So what was it like when your daughter said, "Dad, I'm going to be an actress"?
I said, "There's one thing you have to learn, and that is rejection. If you can put up with that, if you can stand it, because you're going to live a life of rejection. People are going to reject you until the day you die. And there's no star in Hollywood that hasn't faced that. And if you're willing to do that, then go ahead." So she came out to California. She'd been to the Juilliard in New York, studied acting. And she was depressed when she got to California. She was very, very unhappy. And I didn't, you know, there's not an awful lot that a parent can do, but I called my agent, who was a wonderful woman, who had done a lot with me, and I said, "Ina," her name was Ina Bernstein, I said, "Would you, as a favor to me, see my daughter Stephanie?" She said, "Sure, babe, send her over." So Stephanie went to see her, and Ina called me, and she said, "I want to get one thing clear with you. I saw Stephanie as a favor to you. From now on, what happens between Stephanie and me has nothing to do with you at all." And she took her on and just did wonderful things with her. Gave wonderful properties that she put her in for movies of the week and terrific things.
You must have been very proud when she got her own television series, and it was a success on NBC, and that series being Remington Steele.
Oh, I was enormously proud. And appearing on her show was the greatest thrill I had in Hollywood. I never had anything that gave me as much pleasure as playing on Remington Steele.
And you've had some fine leading ladies in your career, from Audrey Hepburn to Lana Turner to Rhonda Fleming.
Oh, yes. I sure did. I just was with Rhonda Fleming tonight.
Oh, really?
On this program that I was on in California here with her new husband, who she married 2 weeks ago. So I just had the pleasure of being with her tonight. Now, we did two movies together, Rhonda and I.
You mentioned Stephanie is working a lot on the stage, and she loves working on stage. You also made a name for yourself on Broadway.
Well, I worked a lot on Broadway. I never became a star on Broadway or anything like that, but I had some wonderful experiences.
Do you have a preference between on stage in front of an audience or working in front of a camera or on a sound stage?
You know, Peter, it's funny. I love the theater. I love the immediacy of it and the contact with an audience. But I always felt that after a certain number of performances, let's say whatever it is, let's say it's 3 months, there's nothing new. that can happen. You're saying the same lines over and over again every night. Nothing, you've played to every kind of audience that there is, the ones who laugh, the ones who snicker, the ones who cry, the ones who applaud. You know them all. And there comes a point where I found myself saying, you know, I am bored with doing this every night, the same old thing. I think there's a point all through rehearsal, it's thrilling. They're developing a part, the play is developing, there's excitement of opening night, and there's opening night itself, there are the reviews and the euphoria that lingers after them, you know, and so forth, and the first audiences. But there comes, in my opinion, there comes a time when it just becomes redundant, and you, that's what I like about film work, whether it's television or movies, that you finish a piece, it's done, and you go on to something else, a new piece, a new thing, a different thing. Even if it's a series, it's a different story. So there's a change, you know. It's not the same thing. And that really is my feeling about it. I love the theater, but if I had to do something like Life with Father for 7 years, I'd be in the loony bin. I couldn't stand it.
You mentioned the reviews. Are you affected by what critics say of your work?
Well, I think you can't help but be a little affected. I mean, it hurts a little if they don't like you. I remember in my early days on Broadway, I appeared in a play of Ibsen's with Eva Le Gallien with my wife, who was a beautiful actress. And somewhere on the pre-opening tour, and we got a review, and it said that the parts of Taya and Arlid Lovborg should be recast. And that was hers and my part. And it was funny, but I mean, it hurt too. I mean, you know, I don't know that you ever... Stephanie won't read reviews. So she just won't do it. For that reason, I think. She doesn't want to know if there are bad things said about her. And it's a tough situation. There are kind reviewers. There are people who try to be constructive in their reviews, but there are others that enjoy destroying the people, and that hurts.
How about dealing with the fans? How have the fans treated you over the years, especially considering most of the roles you've played have been very stand-up kind of guys?
Well, the fans have been wonderful with me. I still are. I'm so grateful to them for their kindness and their support and their interest, and it's what you hope when you play, you know, whether it's a series or a movie or whatever it is, you hope that it's giving people something that may enrich their lives a little bit, and when you learn that it has, it's very, very gratifying. I feel that that's the most gratifying thing about my work. It's not my own advancement or fame or anything like that. It's the fact that some little person who maybe had a tough fight with his mother or his wife or whoever it is tuned in and for an hour sat back and relaxed and felt a little better about life at the end of it. I mean, that to me is the ultimate of what my profession can do. I like that when it happens, and my fans have meant the world to me. I enjoy hearing from them, and I enjoy writing to them.
Is there anything in your career that you, well, actually, let me rephrase that. When you first got into this profession, I'm sure you must have had an idea or vision of where you'd like to be and what you'd like your career to do for you and where you'd like it to take yourself. Did you do what you wanted in your career? Is there anything left to accomplish as far as you're concerned, or you're just happy with the way your career has gone?
I'm very
so
happy
far.
With the way it's gone. There were, you know, it wasn't a steady thing for me. I started out in the very beginning after I came out of drama school being drafted, and I was at the point where I was ready to kill the world. I was young, and I had my whole life in front of me, and I was, you know, ready to bring down giants. And what happened? I went in the army, and I was in for 5 years in World War II. And aside from the general tragedy of that war, you know, on all the world and the devastation that it wrought on the world, it was a personal disaster for me, because I was the moment I was ready to spring, I was locked up in a uniform and had no way of doing anything for 5 years. I thought it was tragic. I thought it was the end of my life. But it happened that I met two people in the Army and had business dealings with them in Europe, and those two people were responsible for my getting my first job on Broadway and for my coming to Hollywood 10 years later. So everything that I have in my life has come out of what I thought was the worst tragedy that could possibly have happened to me, and that was the war.
Well, you've had a great career, and it's not over yet.
No. Well, it's pretty much over as far as acting. I think I'm not going to make too many more faces.
The book is called My Dinner of Herbs. It's just coming out. It's written by Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. I'm looking forward to reading it. I thank you very, very much for being on the program, sir. It's been an honor.
Peter,
and a pleasure
it's
to
been
have
a joy. I really enjoyed so much. You're a wonderful host.